Hey, everybody, it's Kai. Welcome to this edition of the Corner Office Podcast. We're going to dive into the interview I did with Bobby Kotick, the CEO of the gaming company Activision Blizzard, in just a sec. But first, do me a favor, would you? If you like how we're doing with this podcast, go on iTunes, leave us a review. It helps us, well, first of all, with our rankings, honestly, and it helps us figure out what you like and what you don't. And we appreciate it. All right, so anyway, Activision Blizzard is a gaming and entertainment company, one of the biggest in the world in point of fact. Think Call of Duty, World of Warcraft, Guitar Hero. Oh, yes, Candy Crush as well, as you would hear. So I think you could say that Activision Blizzard has range. Headquarters are, as it happens, in Santa Monica, California, not too far from Marketplace World headquarters in downtown L.A., if you time the traffic right. The CEO, as I said, is Bobby Kotick. He is today's guest on Corner Office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Bobby Kotick, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
25-ish years ago, you buy what became this company. It was $30 million in debt, arguably bankrupt. Why?
Well, it was actually bankrupt.
Actually, okay. Yeah. So the question even more now is why?
You know, I think there were a few things that attracted me to the opportunity. The first was I just believed that video games were going to be a powerful form of entertainment. And when I was in college, my freshman and sophomore year, I played Activision games. And so I'd known the company. I'd started a software company in my college dorm room years earlier. And I knew the franchises. I knew the games. And I thought that there was an opportunity. Now, I had a few years earlier, I had an opportunity to explore buying Commodore, the computer company from Canada.
Yeah.
Commodore. And with the idea of turning their Amiga computer into a video game system. If you think back about the history of video games, so Atari was founded in 1979, and there probably wasn't anything akin to its commercial success in consumer electronics prior to Atari being as successful as it was. And then the business collapsed in 1984. But it was an enormous business. You know, we had tens of millions of customers and enormous amount of engagement even in those days. And the business evaporated. There was no dedicated video game system after Atari. And people thought it was a fad or wasn't really a business opportunity. And then in the late 80s, Commodore introduced this computer called the Amiga.
Right.
And it was fantastic. And the guys who designed it were all ex-Atari engineers. But their aspiration for it was to be a computer workstation, like a Sun microsystem workstation. We thought it would make a great video game system. And so I went with a childhood friend of mine who had a hedge fund and tried to convince the CEO of Commodore to let us buy control of his company and turn the Amiga into a video game system.
Yeah.
He really was not all that enthusiastic about the idea.
But you were going to do interesting stuff. You were going to take like the keyboard out, and you were going to do some interesting things to this you know workstation or whatever it was.
Yeah, well, we thought it had really been designed as a device to play video games.
Yeah.
And so you could play video games on computers at that time, but there wasn't a dedicated video game success. And then in 1988, Nintendo introduced what really was a similar to the original Atari 2600 device called the NES. In the U.S., and it was wildly successful. And I ended up buying control of a little public licensing company that was Nintendo's licensing agency. So we were responsible for selling the license rights for T-shirts and bed sheets and lunchboxes. And I got to know the folks at Nintendo, and I told them, you know, my background was making software. I had a software company, but I was really interested in making video games. And at one point, the chairman of Nintendo was a guy named Howard Lincoln. Said, you have to choose. You can either be our licensing agent or you could be a licensee and make games, but we really don't want you to do both. And he said, but you should go look at Activision. And Activision changed his name and refocused to making productivity software. I went, took a look. I thought it was very expensive at the time, and I didn't think it was a great opportunity. And a year later, the market value of Activision collapsed. They lost a patent infringement judgment to Philips of the Netherlands, and we could buy the company for $2 million. And so against the advice of everybody I knew, who said, why would you buy a bankrupt video game company? Just start a new one if you know, the more of a Silicon Valley mentality, just start the new one. But I loved the library. You know, I
played the James Library,
like Pitfall and River Raid and Kaboom, and these were just great games.
Are you a tech guy then? Because, you know, you've got the history and, you know, you can talk the talk on the tech side. But are you a tech guy or are you an entrepreneur?
I guess I'm a tech entrepreneur. You know, look, I've been doing this since 1983. I've always been interested in technology. I took computer programming in my freshman year, but I'm not a programmer or engineer. But I'm pretty technical.
So what's your biggest challenge right now as, you know, this space and the internet and all of that stuff changes like every day?
I would say, you know, having done this for 26 years, the challenges haven't really changed that much, other than I would say something that is a phenomena of the last 3 years. And that is, it's always been prioritization of opportunity is the big challenge.
Prioritization of opportunity. Explain
right.
that.
So we as a business have so many opportunities for growth, for expansion, for new kinds of content creation.
And so you got to pick one, right, basically.
We have to prioritize the ones that you have. But I have seen this increase in opportunity in the last few years that's come from a variety of things. But start with, for the bulk of my career, we made games for middle-class consumers in developed countries. So you had a $300 console, you had a $1,000 personal computer. All of a sudden, the last 5 years, and we were mainly selling in a small number of countries with middle-class consumers. We now sell in 196 countries today. And it's funny, I'm on the board of Coca-Cola, and they have operations in 204 countries. And I heard we had sold games in 196 countries. I want to know what were the 8 countries that were missing.
What are you missing, yeah.
But, and so the phone has really opened up all of these new opportunities.
So you got to be mobile. Got to be.
Well, the biggest part of the growth of the industry is mobile.
Does that mean bad things then for some of your legacy games that are traditional console games, like Warcraft and like Call of Duty and the big ones that people play on their couch at home?
Look, I would say there remains tremendous opportunity. We've always been a very platform agnostic company. So our attitude is, if you have a display and a microprocessor and a way to control it, we'll create content that is great for you. And there are more places to create great content today than there ever have been before. And that gets back to prioritizing opportunities. But those franchises are enduring franchises. And there are opportunities. We've had Call of Duty games played on virtually every console for the last 14 years. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the idea of having a game that centers around armed conflict through history, you never run out of ideas for Call of Duty games. And so there will always be Call of Duty games, and they'll be played on a variety of devices.
How close an eye do you keep on your competitors? I ask because we talked to the CEO of Electronic Arts a couple of months ago, and we did a little Battlefield demo, and it was cool and all that. How, in a competitive landscape thing, how much do you keep an eye on them?
You know, we're by far the largest company in the category, and I can tell you I look over my shoulder every day. We are, you know, there's just a level of insecurity that you have about being a leader in a business that without that insecurity, I think you get complacency.
So what's your biggest nightmare then? What keeps you up at night?
Well, for me, you know, the thing that I'm focused the most on right now is talent. So sourcing, acquisition of talent, development of talent, making sure we have the right performance aligned with rewards and creating a really great experience for people to work. Because we found if you have the most talented, the most capable, most motivated, the most inspired, creative people, you're going to get that commitment to excellence. And maintaining that as you get bigger, as you have new companies coming in the market that offer different experiences for employees, that, you know, creating a place that is the most desired place to work is like one of the things I spend a lot of time on.
One of the things that comes up in profiles of you that obviously I read doing research is that you are the longest serving CEO of a public technology company in this country, 25-ish years. I can't decide whether to ask you if that makes you a dinosaur or really good at what you do.
Well, I started when I was 11, so I have a huge advantage.
Well, right? I mean, you were 20, right? It was close, 25-ish, whatever it was.
Yeah, look, you know what? I think Larry Ellison, who I think was that.
Yeah, he was, and the guy who used to run Oracle. still owns it, but doesn't run it.
But you know what? One of the things you realize about these companies is that there are people who run businesses as employees and people who run them as owners. And I think that our company culture has always been one of an owner orientation, not just for me, but for the people who work here. So I think that, you know, whether it's me or whoever would succeed me someday far into the future.
like right out of my cold dead hands, is that where you are?
I love what I do. I get up every morning more excited to come to work than I think I ever have. And I've always been pretty excited. But, you know, you see all these opportunities in front of us. We have, you know, the most talented people in the world working here in our industry. And so, you know, I'd love to do this for another 26 years.
There's a quote from you that I read that actually doesn't get answered in the profile. And you asked rhetorically, I guess, how do you make games better every year? How do you surpass yourself every single year when you have to meet the expectations of the market, when you have customers, and when you have investors? Every single year, you got to do that. So how?
You know, I think that was a construct that existed where there was that unique challenge of having to make something new and better every year. The games business has shifted a lot. And so
that's only like a 4-year-old profile that I read, by the way.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was more based on a business construct from a long time ago. Huh. And so here's what I would say is these franchises are much more like sports leagues than they are just entertainment franchises. And so you have the demands of having to create consistently new, compelling, fantastic content, which we do. That's what we do. And so, but you also get the benefit of an enormous amount of input from players. And I think if you're disciplined about listening to your audiences, you get a lot of interesting ideas and a lot of feedback. And obviously there's a lot of data that we get in seeing how people play that we can analyze and see what's exciting for our players. But if you think about how the business has evolved, Call of Duty has a lot more similarities today to the NFL or the Premier League. And so that's something that people don't really appreciate. But if you think about the NFL, there are roughly 66 million fans in the United States. And, you know, the business enterprise, about a $13 billion a year business, largely from broadcast rights, mm-hmm. ticket sales, sponsored licensing. We have 40 million monthly active users mm-hmm. in Call of Duty. So not far off mm-hmm. the number of fans you have in the NFL. And they're playing against each other. And so what's really changed in the business is how social the experiences have become. If you think about organized competition, the opportunities that we have today to celebrate our players, we've never had quite the opportunities that we have today. So you can celebrate your players through recognizing their performance. You can recognize them through competitive experiences. You have organized gameplay. When we host an event today, we're having millions of people tune into the live stream to watch a world championship of a Blizzard game. You have at our BlizzCon event in November, we make tickets available to this event to our players, and the 25,000 tickets will sell out in 6 seconds, literally 6 seconds. And so what you've seen evolve as a medium is much more social, that has much more opportunity to celebrate players than ever before, and that helps you sustain the franchises.
You have said, actually, you think esports, which is what you're talking about here, is going to be bigger than the NFL and the Olympics combined.
If you think about what is unusual about what we create, is the people who are playing these games, who are our players, are so invested and so committed in these experiences. But in a lot of ways, what they're getting is this incredible sense of belonging to a community. So if you're a part of a Hearthstone community, you know, tens of millions of players, or Overwatch, a game we just released, they're the people who are playing these games are so invested, so committed, so engaged, you know, that creates a mm-hmm. responsibility to us to make sure we're delivering them compelling entertainment. But now they have this opportunity to be rewarded, to be recognized, to be celebrated. And you will see that game players who, you know, are competing through like characteristics that actually harken back to why the Olympics were originally created, right? Patience, perseverance, social standing. You know, there was always an integration between education and athleticism in ancient Greece. And I think that what we're seeing today is this opportunity that's emerging to celebrate players in ways that we have never had before.
Can we talk for a second about Warcraft the movie, which I get that you guys didn't actually do as a production studio, but you licensed the game. Do you see huge upside for this company in big screen movies and actual productions?
So what I think is important for us, and again, it's in sort of recognition of the commitment to our players, is if we have franchises that we feel like we can make something great that's adjacent to the content that we regularly create. So if we can make a great Call of Duty TV show that's truly great, or if we can make a great Call of Duty film that really like is, you know, the same commitment to excellence that we have in our games, that's interesting to us. And so we're really not – and that's why we started our studio, right, is to actually create great, compelling entertainment using the same process, the same discipline that we have with making great games. And I was once asked, how do you have such a long track record as a company of consistently introducing great games? And the answer is a really simple one that sometimes you think – you know, this guy Chauncey Gardner, is this like a, you know,
from being there,
right? Is this a ludicrous answer? But it's the, you know, take the time to make them great. And unlike a lot of other media, it is a medium where if you continually stay focused, you don't release the games before they're great, they will, you have a high likelihood of critical success.
Do you, and I ask this to the guy who runs the company that makes both Warcraft and Call of Duty, but also like Candy Crush, and you can't get two more different games. Do you know a great game when you see one?
Sure. But I do. But I think today, you know, we have so many talented, incredible people here that it's a very collaborative effort. And, you know, what makes a
– Yeah, but not the company, right? I get that you guys collaborate. But you, when you sit down and you either pull out your phone or you fire up the console or whatever it is and you go, oh, yeah, no, this isn't it. Or yes. Do you know?
Yeah, sure. I mean, when you see something that is not ready for prime time or has like inspired creativity all around it, you know, I can tell you like my favorite story about seeing something extraordinary. We have lots of those moments here, but I remember two things that happened in my life, well, three things that happened in my life that were those moments where you see like unbelievable excellence, and they inform you a lot about what you're looking for in your own medium. So the first time was 1983, I had my first software company that I started in my college dorm room, and I was invited by Steve Jobs to come to Apple and show him this software that I created for the Apple II. And
it was like a simulation, we should say, or something, right? It was a simulation of their software. No?
Well, it was loosely inspired.
Because Steve Jobs doesn't just call you, let's just say that.
Well, it's John Sculley who actually called first. But right. It was there was a computer that they had created called the Lisa.
Lisa, right.
And we had seen it. My college roommate had worked at Apple Computer in France. And he saw it and said, hey, here's this $10,000 workstation. We should make the same kind of experience for the Apple II. And so what we made was a Windows-like operating system before there was Windows or a Macintosh and a mouse for the Apple II. So Apple had heard about it. They invited us to come to Cupertino. We give Steve the demo. He actually threw my mouse on the floor and said it was clunky and ugly and why would we sell it? And then he unzipped this little blue bag and he pulled a prototype of the Macintosh out and turned it on. And I could remember like it was yesterday. I could tell you what he was wearing, but you know, the little hello came up and I looked at it and I thought, wow, this will change the world. And it was one of those moments where you realize you're like seeing something that is going to actually have a transformative effect on society. The second time I saw that was, another time that I saw that was actually also a Steve Jobs related experience. But we were making Toy Story, we're pitching Toy Story for the rights to make it for a video game. And I went up to see John Lasseter and Steve came and they showed me the first 15 minutes of Toy Story. And I walked away thinking this is going to transform entertainment forever. But my favorite one relates more to our own industry. And you see lots of experiences and have lots of experiences where you see something that is like what you're describing, a moment where you say this is something beautiful or extraordinary or has great potential. This one, I was in Kyoto, and Mr. Owada and Mr. Miyamoto, the two heads of Nintendo, said, "We want to show you something." And I went in this room, and there was a little table like this, and there was an old TV, you know, like a tube TV. And then there was a cardboard box, and they had a little black box on it. And he had these two wands, and he gave me one, and he took one. And all I saw on the TV was a pond, just like a little pond with water. And he gave me the wand and said, "Go fishing." And, like, it didn't take any thought. I just went like this. Huh. And all of a sudden, I saw, like, the kerplop of the lure and the water splash. And I held the wand, and I was holding it. As I was holding it, the force feedback started, and I could feel the fish on. And I pulled the fish out. And I thought, this is going to completely transform video games. Because the idea that you have a physical experience, you know, it's a very visceral experience. And the controller is something that you do have this unusual visceral relationship to, but this was something really different. And I remember walking away thinking, this is going to open up whole new opportunities for games and who they're going to be appealing to. And I think the phone has done something very similar, that you can carry this thing around you. The games that you play on phones today are a lot like games that were made 10 years ago and 15 years ago. Some of the big differences are the social components, which didn't exist. But the idea that you have this piece of glass that you could touch, that you can move, that has an accelerometer that can actually change the position, or what you see happening with Pokemon Go today.
Oh, yeah, right. You know, you wish you had a slice of that?
Of course. Actually, you know what? I wish we invented it because it's so fun, you know? And, like, I was in New York 2 days ago, and I was standing around the plaza, and I saw 500 people standing in the middle of the park at the plaza all looking for a character. We've had it on our own campuses, too. But, you know, it's something you see these, like – and we've had a lot of these – fortunately, a lot of these kinds of, like, world-changing experiences. Overwatch is a great example, a game we just released. But, you know, the speed with which we've built almost 15 million-person audience now – and it's around the world. And so if you look in the game rooms in Korea or the players in China or what's happening in the U.S. or Europe with Overwatch, you see an enormous amount of engagement. And this is a 6-on-6 competitive game. So that means you need 12 people playing all at the same time. And we have millions of people who are playing it. And so, like, those are these moments that are, you know, they give you that incredible energy to know that what you're doing is something that really has meaning and importance.
There's a question to be asked here about who this company is for, because you have, I think it's fair to say, gotten in some trouble in the past talking about got to make investors happy because we're a for-profit company, while gamers have said, wait a minute, you're making this thing that is our lives, basically. You have been called the most hated man in video games. How do you reconcile what you do? For-profit company versus a huge lifestyle operation.
Look, our focus is creating compelling entertainment for our audiences. That's what we do. And so whenever, like, those comments are taken out of context, which they usually are taken out of context, but you know, we're a public company. We have an obligation and a responsibility to our stakeholders, debt holders, shareholders. But at the end of the day, I think we've always adopted a philosophy that if you create compelling entertainment, that audiences will find their way to it. And you do have a commercial responsibility. But, you know, the primary responsibility that we feel as a company is to our players.
I wonder if you've learned a lesson or two as this company has risen in prominence and your role in this community has increased. Because you here today, and granted we've only been sitting here for half an hour, you're a far more subdued interview than your clippings make you out to be, if that makes any sense.
Well, I don't do this often, for starters. So, I rarely do it. I think there was a comment I made in 2008 that was taken out of context.
Made people go crazy. I mean,
but it was all in the spirit of humor, and was at a conference where I made a comment to be funny and explain why we were hiring people from Procter & Gamble. And so it was just meant to be funny, taken out of context. But my philosophy about who our responsibility is to has never changed.
What's the best part of this job?
There's so many great parts of the job, but I would say that one of the great parts of the job that has also been a great benefit of just success as a business person is access to incredible people and having the ability to have mentors and supporters and advisors who I would probably, but for the success of the business, I would never have access to. So, you know, like being able to pick up the phone and call Warren Buffett or Charlie Munger or John Lasseter. I mean,
do you actually do that?
I do.
I've always wondered about CEOs at your level, whether you guys just pick up the phone and talk.
You know, I would say that it's probably one of the great privileges. You know, I have the benefit of a lot of privilege. I work with some of the most talented people on earth, some of the most like inspired, creative people that you could ever imagine working with. I have the ability to pick up the phone and call almost anybody and get my phone call returned. And I think that the privilege that affords you also comes with the responsibility of making sure that you don't waste people's time. So, you know, when I get the benefit of being with a Warren Buffett or a Charlie Munger or a John Lasseter, I want to mainly do listening. It's funny, I was having dinner with my friend Norman Lear not long ago, and I said
to him, name dropper, hello, come on.
I'm only thinking about because he just launched this American Masters movie.
Yeah.
And I said, Norman, I don't want to do any of the talking. I just want to do the listening. And he said, what fun is that for me? And I said, you know what? When I have to balance your fun and my ability to soak up wisdom and insight, I'm taking my ability to listen to your wisdom and insight. But it's an incredible privilege.
Bobby, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Kai.
All right, that's it for this episode of Corner Office. We made a sound quiz for those of you who think you really know video games, which is not, by the way, me. Take it, though. See how it goes. You can find it at our website, marketplace.org. Thanks a lot for listening. Another episode of Corner Office in a couple of weeks.